The Veritas Radio Network and the Crusade Channel present Kurt Wallace's The Flow. Real interviews with real people revealing real truths. Heard exclusively on the Veritas Radio Network's Crusade Channel and available online at veritasradionetwork.com. Radio, the way it should be.
Presented by Veritas Radio Network's Crusade Channel, I'm Kurt Wallace, and this is The Flow. Our guest today is Jeffrey Tucker, Director of Digital Development at FEE, Foundation of Economic Education, and founder of Liberty.me. He joins me to discuss how society, government regulations, and politics have altered the job and career landscape in the U.S. over the last 100 years, how the attitudes have changed in terms of approaching and getting a job and having a career. He shares ways to get an edge in the marketplace with tips on job interviewing and entrepreneurship. Tucker explains why his techniques include actually hacking our minds and our perceptions and the way we see things to become more independent of market influences as they exist today. This is an interview you won't hear anywhere else. Jeffrey, thanks for spending some time with us today on The Flow.
It's a pleasure to be here. I'm excited about the topic.
Jeffrey, you've been on the show before, and we went over a whole variety of things in terms of your life. And we talked about this, how anarchism is all sorts of things, including your Catholicism and being a father. And so we went on sort of a personal journey. But can we take that personal perspective and get a bit of a world overview and then try to tackle the marketplace and the lifestyle within the work environment, the course of anarchy and how that can be hacked into a career? And so,
I'm excited about the topic because people are just dreadful at managing their careers in the professional life, and it's partially because they don't get any training in this, and also because they tend to, as with everything else in our society, they kind of go along with what they've been told, and they haven't rethought it for themselves, and they could find themselves at some point in their lives completely confused and lost and unemployed and essentially broke, unless you start rethinking your relationship to the job marketplace. I think it's an extremely important topic. And my experience so far suggests that very few people have really thought seriously about this.
Let's get a big picture of it then, starting with history, because I think that we have to look at how people were motivated and they had their why, if you will, at one point in history where people were driven by whatever they wanted. Now things have changed.
Everything changed in the course of the 20th century. In the 19th century, it was a no-brainer. If you read any of the biographies of some of the Gilded Age entrepreneurs, they all talked about how they started working at the age of 7 and 8, working on a barge, moving logs, in ice houses, breaking ice, working on the farm, you name it. But they were working from before the age of 10, and there was a formative influence for them. And that's how they developed a sense of the rhythm of life, about what it means to be valuable to others, the relationship between work and reward. These were extremely formative experiences, and they chose their careers based on this perception that I am a productive unit, and I'm going to I bear primary responsibility for allocating this productive unit in ways that it's most lucrative and most compatible with my aims in life. And if anything should go wrong, it's my fault. And this is how people, the market, tended to socialize people, and they prepared their lives according to a map that they laid out that was very much tied in with their work. In the 20th century, changed everything. For one thing, earlier in the 20th century, government began to intervene in the job marketplace in ways that would have been inconceivable in the past. For example, establishing minimum wages, maximum working hours, regulating who could work past 6 p.m., these kinds of things. This is as early as 1908. And, you know, the motivations for this are widely misunderstood. It wasn't about worker protection. It was really about eugenics and demographic planning. But in any case, it changed our relationship to the job marketplace. It began to change it. And then we got child labor laws, you know, in the 1930s, which, you know, have made it illegal for anybody to have the kind of jobs they had in the 19th century. As far as I'm concerned, it's a violation of human rights. And even to today, you can't really work in a wide range of areas of American life until you're, you know, as much as 18. I mean, 16-year-old is more conventional, but your paths are very limited. So you have to be 18 or so to work, which is absurd. And then most people don't do it. So they go to college instead, and they're still kept out of the job marketplace. And then, you know, this horrible thing happened in World War II. I don't mean to just try to give a brief thumbnail sketch of this, but after World War II, our business places became miniature welfare states, providing, you know, health benefits, and they started collecting taxes for us. We began to provide us pensions. They became like miniature governments, you know, on government mandate. And what it did is it messed with everybody's minds. Now people tend to think of their job as to leave school and sort of hurl themselves into some institution where they bury their egos, bury their productive capacities, and just depend on an institution to take care of them the rest of their lives. This is a terrible, terrible way to manage your professional career, and yet it's what we've been encouraged to do.
And also, there has been this kind of a sense that politics will in some way free us from these institutions, give us an ability to not have the regulations and that sort of thing. So politics has failed us too. That right. is an important part of this whole experience.
Well, they work together. I mean, a great example of this is Obamacare, because, you know, Obamacare was an incredible calamity for the American worker. And I think people are just now starting to realize this. I've never seen so much panic over health benefits as I see today. It wasn't anything like this 10 years ago. 10 years ago, if you lost your job, you could get a decent plan that was just for catastrophic care. You know, low premiums, probably a reasonably high deductible, but the healthcare costs were much lower. And you weren't living in a constant state of fear. Now, people understand if they lose their jobs, you know, they're just a few weeks away from being completely without healthcare. And they go out into the marketplace to try to buy something. And what they find are these loaded up plans. They're loaded up on the surface, actually. They're not very good in the details, but they're very expensive. And they can't afford even to use them at all. And their biggest fear is that they'll be sent to a specialist or have to go to the hospital for an appendix or something. They'll be presented with bills that are, you know, $4,000 and $5,000 that they have to pay. They ended up paying $200, $300, $400 or more per month. Families, you know, are being asked to pay, you know, $1,000 a month. It's crazy. People are paying more for, like, renting bad health insurance than they're paying even for their rent of their apartments and their homes. And this is all thanks to Obamacare. It's an unbelievable calamity, and as we know, Obamacare wasn't just about welfare benefits. I mean, it's not given any at all. Obamacare was about sort of bringing together the interests of the interest in insurance and pharmaceutical industries together with the medical industry generally in ways that allied with the interests of the largest corporations. I mean, so it was a classic sort of racket, really, and the working class has really been screwed over by the whole thing.
Let's take these two issues to start with. Well, before we do this, I'm going to ask you about key points: child development, alternatives to healthcare, hacking in these aspects. But before we do that, we need an overview of Keynesian influence in the economy as well. In a way, get this kind of visual of being strangled as individuals that are locked in a system, right?
So it's terrible, yeah. And if you have children, it's especially tragic. I mean, even when I was turning 11 or 12, the same child labor laws existed, but everything was much looser. You didn't have these kind of intense controls. You know, the Department of Labor wasn't leaning on you, and the Immigration Service wasn't investigating your papers. So I was able to get all sorts of awesome jobs from the age of 11 and 12. You know, I was moving organs, repairing fences, digging wells, you know, just every kind of job you could possibly imagine. I was, you know, helping with the piano moving and catering companies, and always paid in cash, of course, but nobody ever thought anything about it. I got my first W-2 job when I was 15 just by simply wink-wink, you know, lying about my age, and nobody really cared, you know, and that wasn't that too long ago. Now, you are just completely shut out of the workforce, and it's terrible because, you know, people are 22 and 23 years old throwing themselves in the job marketplace without the slightest clue about what a job is, what you're supposed to do, what the expectations for you are, how do you become valuable. I mean, Kurt, it's really very, very tragic what's going on today, that you have so many millions upon millions of people wandering around in their college years and after, completely oblivious about what a job is and what the nature of the exchange relationship of employment really comes down to. They just don't know. It's not their fault, but they just don't know because they've never had any contact with commercial marketplace.
So in the Keynesian structure then, that how would you see or be able to describe that seeping into public education and just the development years for, say, age 8 to 22?
Well, it's one of the things that's horrible about the Keynesian structure is that they reduce everything to statistics, you know. So, you know, in the New Deal, one of the reasons for the passage of the Todd labor laws was that it made a whole class of people, took them off the job market. So they were immediately able to hack the job numbers. That was the whole purpose. Mm-hmm. You take millions of people out of the job marketplace and, like magic, your unemployment rate plummets, you know? So that was a terrible racket. And now, you know, we tend to associate a good economy with low unemployment rates, and that's exactly what we have today. We have 5% unemployment, but it doesn't tell you anything about whether or not people are happy in their jobs. It's sort of socialistic in a sense. It's like if you had a statistic that was trying to figure out if enough people had shoes or enough people had pants, and you came up with a statistic that said 100% pant ownership, you know, and then you wrote it off and said, well, I guess everybody's, you know, content. But what if people didn't have the pants or the shoes they wanted? You know, what if they were walking around in stuff that they didn't like and had no choices about it? It doesn't measure anything about job satisfaction or life satisfaction. Just because you have people that on paper are reporting having some kind of job, that doesn't indicate anything about whether or not they're really happy or whether or not they're free to choose another job if they want to. They're really not. People are stuck in their jobs. And the irony to me, Kurt, about all of this stuff is that if you look at any of these things like mandated benefits, unemployment insurance, health care especially, and so on and so on, they were all pushed in the name of worker rights, giving the worker more stuff. But the effect of it has been exactly the opposite. It's made the worker more dependent on the status quo, on his or her existing job, and less willing to look for another position or put himself or herself on the market, and made them more tolerant towards those micro-despotisms, you know, that you get at the office place. In other words, it's tilted the balance of power in favor of the employer and against the employee, despite all the advertising and all the propaganda to the contrary.
And now with the social matrix, how society perceives when someone is to be motivated. We see kids just not in that position anymore. The way you described it before, there was pride in developing as a child. As a matter of fact, my son's mom started working on a farm when she was 11 or 12 years old, and that's been instilled in her, so she wants my son to be working on a farm. at 11 or 12 years old. But that this is, to me, that is a demonstration of, hey, I got value out of this, and I want to pass that along. What is a hack that, or a series of hacks that we can start with?
Well, for your own children, that is, yes. It gets to be very difficult actually these days, especially if you live in a city, mm-hmm. Because there just aren't jobs around anymore. If you live out in the rural areas, you're more likely to find something for somebody who will employ your child for cash. But if you live anywhere in a city, it's going to be much more difficult. People are less willing to deal in cash. You know, there are a few jobs that a kid can have in. You know, like mowing the lawn, mowing lawns, and that sort of thing, and that's a good start. Unfortunately, the problem with those kind of positions is that they do really require a certain self-starting sort of individual, and not every 12, 13 year old kid has got that kind of motivation to get out and sell himself or herself as a great person who can mow your yard. I mean, that's. Children that age really do need structure, and they need that kind of discipline, and they need a boss. You know, I don't know how else to put it. So it can be very difficult. But if you keep your eye up from the time your child is young and cultivate a friendship network, you might be able to come up with something. Another alternative is that nowadays there's a lot of opportunities online. If your child is technologically savvy, there's many kinds of ways that they can do freelance work for very low amounts of money, put themselves out there on Elance or Odesk, or I guess it's called Upwork now, and they can sometimes get paid that way. And this is also where cryptocurrency can be helpful. They can get paid in Bitcoin and bypass the whole system. But whatever it is, I mean, you are not doing your kid any favor by keeping them out of the labor marketplace until after college. That's just crazy.
Well, I had a part-time job. I actually mowed lawns. I sold Jolly Ranchers when I was in elementary school on the bus. Mm-hmm. I did a lot of things like that. And I know that there are kids that have that kind of entrepreneurial spirit. But in terms of the way that the conditioning that's occurred to hinder the encouragement of working, can you speak to how we've gotten here?
Well, it's been terrible for children because they don't know anything about the job marketplace. I know that myself. When I hire people out of college, I know I just expect that I have to spend 3 months, 6 months, up to a year or longer, just getting them used to what it is like to be in a work environment, to relate. You wouldn't think it would be so hard. I mean, you and I are talking as sort of seasoned workers, but actually, from a young age. You know, you've got to be taught this, and if you're just discovering this after college, this relationship between what you the value you bring to your employment is reflected in the wages you're paid, and there's a relationship between those two. Mm-hmm. And the relationship works like this: you have to provide vastly more value going into the company than you're taking out of the company, or else the exchange will not continue to occur. And people have that a little bit, lots of young people have this a little bit wrong. They feel like if they're not being paid more than minimum wage or something like that, that they're not going to provide more value than what they estimate the minimum wage should ask them to do. So they're kind of waiting for a raise before they start being amazing, you know, at the marketplace.
Sure.
And I can just say that is not the way to get ahead. I mean, that is just a sure path to loserdom. What you really need to do in any job marketplace is just provide massive value as soon as you possibly can and forget at how low you're being paid. Your wages will eventually catch up to your level of productivity. Maybe not at that firm, but possibly at the next job and the next job, which is something we need to talk about too, namely staying on the job marketplace.
Yeah, let's go ahead and do that. Let's assume that someone has overcome this sense of ego in terms of getting involved in the workplace, and they're bringing as much as they can. You know, in other words, the adage that when all else fails, do good work. And then suddenly there are job cuts, or the company goes defunct or, you know, something, whatever it is, and you and the person loses their job, what are some things that, from an anarchist perspective, that they can...
Well, let me say this, that the worst time to look for a job is when you've lost a job.
Okay.
That is absolutely terrible. It's like you don't really want to be shopping for cars after your car has been crashed and doesn't work anymore, and you're in a little bit of panic. You're going to buy anything, and you're going to pay too high a price.
Right.
The time to get sophisticated about the car market is when you have a working car and everything's going awesome for you. Just kind of keep an eye out for, you know, a good deal out there, ready to sell your car and buy another car. That's the way good entrepreneurs deal it, do with it. When it comes to the labor market, you should be doing the same thing. People often make this mistake. They get a really good job. It's paying them really well. They've got all the benefits they want. They're living in a place they like. They like their boss. And they take themselves off the job market. They neglect their LinkedIn accounts, or they don't make one at all, which is just a disaster. And they just wait it out, and they get used to their stability. And then suddenly they find things have changed. And next thing you know, they suddenly discover they don't have the right skill set to get out on the job marketplace. Their resume looks a little bit shabby. They're rushing to update it. They suddenly realize that there's a lot of things they should have been learning that they didn't learn. You know, they've kind of been left behind, you know? So here's my very strong advice. Never stop looking for your next job. And that's very serious. No matter how good your current job is, you should always keep your LinkedIn account updated and keep your eye out for another position. People get very confused about this. They think that if they're out there looking for another job, that's somehow a betrayal of their current employer. That is completely wrong. You need to be throwing applications out there. You might love your current job. You're in a very happy position, whatever. But if you're keeping your eye out for other positions that are in your within your skill set, there's nothing wrong with submitting your application to it. I mean, you know, it's not often you get a call back. I mean, you realize this once you get on the job market. It's hard these days to get a job. So you have to be really good at it. You have to be practiced at it. And the time to practice is when you're really happy at your current employment. So if you have one or two applications going out, you know, every few months, what you're doing is you're testing your worth on the job marketplace. If you're a graphics designer, and you suddenly find that every single job you apply for, you never get a callback. It's an automatic turndown. That tells you something. It tells you that there's something wrong with your skill set. You need to upgrade. You need to learn some new software. You need to develop your own personal portfolio. Whatever it is, you're going to get information back based on that job application. And, okay, let's say you do get a callback and you go to an interview. Is it somehow dishonest to interview for a job that you're not really sure you want? I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I mean, when it comes right down to it and you get the offer, you can look at the salary and go, well, that's not much better than I'm doing now. Or let's say it's a third more, but you really don't want to move to New York. You know, the truth is that most people would accept a new position under the right salary conditions. You don't know necessarily what those are going to be. So there's nothing wrong with testing out the market and finding out whether you can excel at it. And also, there is nothing wrong with saying no. You know, if you get called back for an interview and you finally get an offer, you can look at it. If there's something wrong with it, it doesn't pay enough, or it's in a city you don't like, or you've developed some doubts about the work climate, you don't feel like you're going to have enough responsibility, and you know, whatever, or you don't want to be part of such a big team, or you don't want, you know, all the responsibility comes. So you can always say no. There's nothing wrong with that. But at least you've tested your skill set on the job marketplace and found out something about yourself. Do you see what I mean? Because otherwise, people's skills tend to atrophy until it's too late. So my view is the time to apply for a new job is right now, even if you love what you're doing. Test to make sure the liquidity of your own skill set right now. That's a great hack for your life. And what it means is that you're becoming less dependent. You're basically freer, and you develop a consciousness of yourself as a free agent selling your services to the highest bidder out there, the best quality bargainer out there, And that is a wonderfully empowering thing to feel in life. And Kurt, if you understand that you do have options in life, it makes you a better worker wherever you are right now. You're more confident. You're more exuberant. You're not as worn down. You're aware that you can pick up and go anytime. You're willing to take more risks at the office. You're willing to be a little more daring and creative in how you undertake your job. You're less willing to take a bunch of guff from a boss you don't like, and so on. It improves the quality of your life to think of yourself as an independent, productive unit.
Jeffrey, we're going to have to take a short break. We will be back on the flip side of the break. You're listening to The Flow with Kurt Wallace, our special guest, Jeffrey Tucker.